now call case number 2009 CA1130 Condo against Connors. Mr. Plott, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is J.C. Plott, attorney registration number 35985. I represent the plaintiff appellant Elizabeth Condo in this matter. This is a case of the defendant's appellee's tortious interference of the contract made between plaintiff Elizabeth Condo and her former husband, Thomas Banner. In 2005, the Banner marriage dissolution proceeding.
Mr. Plott, can I ask you to speak a little louder or bring that microphone in closer?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
In 2005, the Banner marriage dissolution proceeding was wrapping up. Mr. Banner was the member of the Hut at Avon LLC with a one-third membership interest in that company. Defendants Mr. Connors and Mr. Roberts each owned a third of that company. In summer of 2005, Mr. Banner presented Mr. Roberts and Mr. Connors with a proposed assignment of his right to receive distributions from the Hut at Avon, along with a consent to the substitution of Mrs. Condo as a member in place of Mr. Banner, and with that, a waiver of the member's right of first refusal for the transaction. Mr. Connors and Mr. Roberts denied their consent and chose not to exercise the right of first refusal. A year later, they purchased Mr. Banner's membership interest in the Hut at Avon at a fire sale price. Mrs. Condo brought suit against the defendants for tortious interference with her assignment from Mr. Banner. The defendants moved for summary judgment, asserting that Mr. Banner breached the Hut at Avon operating agreement, and therefore the assignment was invalid. The district court held that the assignment's voting provision violated Colorado law, and that Mr. Banner breached the operating agreement by failing to act in good faith, and therefore the assignment was void. The district court also held that Mr. Banner failed to act in good faith because he made the assignment to Mrs. Condo, and therefore the assignment was void on this ground as well. The court is familiar with the briefs. The validity or invalidity of this assignment is not the issue here because Mrs. Condo could pursue her claim for tortious interference even if the assignment were invalid. The ultimate legal question that must be resolved by the court is whether, as the defendants claim, Mr. Banner's alleged breach of the operating agreement and his subsequent assignment of the right to receive distributions to Mrs. Condo should be void. And I don't think that any of the appellees would contest that the district court, seriously contest that the district court erred in failing to reform the assignment's voting provision in line with Riley v. Korholz.
Mr. Plott, I'd like you to repeat because I'm trying to, you said that the issue is not the validity of the contract, but then you also referred to Mr. Connor's argument that the contract is void. Are you using those terms distinctly, or I'm just not following what you're saying about that. If validity of the contract is not an issue, then whether the contract is void is or is not an issue?
Whether the contract is void, a legal nullity, is the issue.
Okay.
If the assignment was invalid, it would still be actionable for tortious interference under the law of this state.
Okay.
Moving on to the voting restriction.
And I want to ask a question about that. You talked about reformation, and in the briefs, in your briefs on appeal, you talk a lot about severability. Were any of those arguments ever made to the trial court?
I do not believe that off the top of my head, Your Honor, I believe it might be in the supplemental, plaintiff supplemental briefing, yes.
In where?
The plaintiff's supplemental briefing.
I'll tell you what, counsel, why don't you, if you reserve any time, you can resume.
Certainly, that would be page 8 of plaintiff's supplemental briefing. Actually, page 8 and 9 of the plaintiff supplemental briefing.
Thank you.
Certainly. Similarly, I don't think that the appellees can honestly contest the question of Mr. Banner's good faith being decided on a motion for summary judgment. Good faith is a question of fact that should be reserved to the fact finder. What we have now are the defendants asking this court to extend really the holding of Blue Dolphin Investments v. Kane, in which a different division of the Court of Appeals followed the restatement second of contracts and stated that a promise that tortiously interferes with the performance of a contract with a third person or a tortiously induced promise to commit a breach of contract is unenforceable on grounds of public policy. This is not a Blue Dolphin case. This is not a case where Mr. Banner or Mrs. Kondo acted tortiously. This is not a case where the defendants have alleged or proven such tortious conduct on a motion for summary judgment. In order to properly determine that the assignment was void against public policy, the district court really should have explained what illegal or tortious conduct on the part of Mr. Banner or Mrs. Kondo made the assignment either malum prohibitum or malum in se. The district court's reliance on the voting provision, which should have been stricken, was erroneous. The district court's reliance on Mr. Banner's good faith was inappropriate. There are no facts alleged or provable in summary judgment to support a finding that there existed a tort or illegality in what Mr. Banner and Mrs. Kondo did. In short, the defendants claimed that Mr. Banner breached the operating agreement. Even if he did so, there is no authority in this state that stands for the proposition that breach of contract by a party to that contract is tortious or illegal. Simple breach of contract, which is what the defendants are claiming Mr. Banner did here, is simply a breach of contract. It is not evil unto itself.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Plott, but isn't the real issue here the effect of that assignment clause? Because if the non-assignment clause in and of itself is against public policy for reasons associated with freedom of contract and dealing with third parties issues, isn't that sufficient?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, that the non-assignment clause of the operating agreement?
Yes.
Is in itself void?
No, doesn't that the non-assignment clause of the operating agreement basically say that you can't assign this stuff? And thus, isn't the assignment in this case against public policy because it's against the policies behind the non-assignment clause?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I don't think that that makes the contract or the assignment void. It may, as the Eagle District Court said, make it invalid, but does it rise to the level of making it void? And the defendants have cited numerous bankruptcy cases where they were a wholly different set of public policy concerns is at issue, and the courts have come variously on and ruled that those assignments were void. But we're talking about something that is going to be made a legal nullity. I think the standard is slightly different from perhaps breaching the contract, but Mr. Banner allegedly breached the contract and making a subsequent contract. Does that make it void?
Are you telling us today that you agree that the subsequent assignment is at the very least invalid under your analysis? In other words, voidable?
The subsequent assignment may be invalid. That is a decision, of course, for the court. The question of is it malum in se, is it evil in itself? I don't think that the court can honestly say that the public policy of the state of Colorado is to say, yes, this assignment is going to be void. And you have, if you look to the reasoning in Blue Dolphin versus what we have here, there you had a tortious action, what really was a fraud that the plaintiff wanted to perpetrate. That would have been good ground, probably, to say, yes, this would have been void. But we don't have that fraud here. We don't have a tort here. We have, if as the defendants are correct, a simple breach.
Are you familiar with the case of Parish Chiropractic versus Progressive Casualty?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
All right, it's a Colorado Supreme Court case. I'm going to ask the other side as well if they're familiar with that case, but I want to read you, it's an insurance case, and thus I understand there may be some distinctions involved,
but I want to read you a sentence from that case. Where the contract in question specifically prohibits the assignment of rights or interests under the contract without the consent of one or more of the contracting parties, any purported assignment without such consent will not be enforced. Well, that's our Supreme Court. What does that tell me?
That tells me, Your Honor, that the assignment could not be enforced against the maker of the assignment, but that does not reach, again, we're talking void. What you're saying from parish chiropractic, as I understand it, is that if I make an invalid assignment, you are not at, to anyone, that person is not at liberty to enforce the terms of that assignment against the body that would have allowed me to make the assignment. That person would not have been able to enforce the assignment against the corporation. It does not say void. It may be unenforceable, but I think the distinction is key here. And with that, if there are no further questions, I will reserve the remainder.
Counsel for Appalese, I realize that you've submitted separate briefs. How do you intend to use your oral argument?
I'm going to argue on behalf of all defendants.
Okay.
So if I may start. May it please the court, I'm John Armand of Kennedy, Childs, and Fogg, counsel for the defendant Appalese Wendell Porterfield. With me at counsel tables.
Can you set the clock, please?
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
With me at counsel table is Michael Berger, counsel for the defendants Appalese, Connors, and Roberts. Well, this case is neither as complicated nor as difficult as Mr. Plott has tried to make it. In fact, Judge Bernard, you are right on point. Contrary to what Mr. Plott just said, the validity of the assignment is indeed an issue. In fact, it is the issue. And that's really the only issue that this court needs to decide to affirm the trial court, and that is whether a purported assignment of a membership interest in a limited liability company is void ab initio if it was made without the prior written consent of the LLC's other members, where such consent is expressly required by the LLC's operating agreement for an assignment to be effective. If the assignment of Mr. Banner's interest in the Hutt Group was void from the beginning, then the plaintiff's tortious interference claim fails as a matter of law because there is no tortious interference with a void contract. Now, the basis for the trial court's holding the assignment void was the fact that it was a transfer of a membership interest in the LLC that did not have the other members' prior written consent, which violated the restriction on transfers in Section 10.1 of the LLC's operating agreement. And because the assignment violated the operating agreement, it was void because the transfer was ineffective. And Mr. Banner's purported assignment to his wife was ineffective vis-a-vis the LLC. For example, if there's a statute that says a person who has a right to distribution stands in the position of a creditor of the LLC. If she had come into court and tried to enforce that against the LLC, she wouldn't have succeeded because the assignment was void as against the LLC because it was accomplished without the member's prior written consent, which is a requirement for any transfer of any portion of any membership interest that's set forth in the operating agreement.
Can I ask a question? Yeah, kind of a hypothetical. If in the divorce proceeding, the wife had gotten the court to make as part of the permanent orders a provision in the orders that said, okay, you, Mr. Banner, you're going to get distributions from this LLC. I'm hereby ordering you, when you get those, endorse them over to your wife. Would the partners have had any say in that at all?
No, and we wouldn't be here today if that happened.
That's why I'm asking.
Because what happened here wasn't an attempt to just assign the distributions themselves or the proceeds of the distributions. That could have been accomplished quite easily. You set up a bank account that Banner doesn't have access to, and you order the court, in divorce court, or by private agreement, he can just have the distributions paid directly from the LLC into that private bank account. Then you wouldn't have an assignment of a right to receive distributions or any other portion of a membership interest. That was completely unnecessary, but because they tried to do it this way, they ran into that provision of the operating agreement that says transfers or assignment of any portion of any membership interest must have the prior written consent of the other members of the LLC, and without that, it's ineffective. Really, the plaintiff's arguments on appeal are just arguing around this issue. I mean, there seems to be some kind of notion that you can make an assignment can be effective without the consent of the members of the LLC, but it can't. It says that right in the contract, and there's another provision in section 10.6 of the agreement that says that even it says, for purpose of the agreement, restrictions on the sale, assignment, or disposition of a member's interest shall extend to any direct or indirect transfer, including without limitation and voluntary transfer. So that requirement that you need to have the approval of the prior written consent of the other members before you can assign even the right to receive distributions from the LLC, that means that you can't have an assignment without that consent.
Why does it mean that? I mean, as I read the restrictions, it says a member shall not sell or assign. And it doesn't say may not. It doesn't say anything about any such assignment will be ineffective. All it says is you must not do this. And he agrees that I must not do this. And then he goes and does it. Why isn't it just a simple breach?
Well, as between the LLC and the it's not a simple breach because the verb shall, that's usually, in statutory interpretation, it's taken to mean as mandatory. In other
mandatory
words,
must.
He can't do it. He has no authority to sell or to assign any portion of his interest in the company without that consent. It's like trying to sell property you don't have title to.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. The word shall is mandatory. We can look at it as being must. You must not sell, which seems to me mandatory on him. It is an obligation on him, and he violated that obligation. How does it affect the validity or how does it make this act that he does anything other than a breach of his agreement with his partners?
Because he lacked the authority. In order to transfer any kind of property or any interest, you have to have the authority to transfer that.
So tell me how the words here tell me he is without authority. It seems to me it is saying to him he has certain obligations to them, but how is it saying to him that you lack authority, it's invalid, it's without force and effect, you may not do this?
I think under the plain meanings of the terms, it says, notwithstanding anything to the contrary. In other words, this section stands out above them all. It applies regardless of what you think it says. Without the prior written approval of all of the members, a member shall not sell, assign, or pledge, or otherwise transfer a portion of interest. In other words, if you don't have that prior written consent, you just don't have the authority to do it. And anything attempt to do it is just void. Now, we cited a case in the complaint our answer brief that prevented a similar situation, and that involved an attempt by a church committee it's the American Lutheran Church versus Evangelical Lutheran St. Paul's Church case. It had to do with an attempt by a church committee, I believe, to sell or to convey interest in church property when they didn't have the authority to do that from the church's governing board. And what the Supreme Court said in that case, well, that was ultra vires. It was beyond your power to do it.
Right. So there was, the church organization owned something, and someone who had no authority on behalf of the church to alienate the church's ownership acted ultra vires. They simply didn't have the power to do this. But the corporation here doesn't own that interest. It was Mr. Banner who owned
the
interest.
No, but the corporation has placed restrictions on that interest that says you, Mr. Banner might own that interest, but he can only transfer it in accord with the provisions of the operating agreement, and that is fully consistent with.
What do you say? Because your analogy there is a situation in which somebody is transferring something they don't own. Whereas here, Mr. Banner, do you dispute that Mr. Banner owned this interest?
No, I think in the church case, they transferred property they didn't have authority to transfer. Here, the same thing.
Well, pardon me, they didn't have authority. These individuals in the church case did not have ownership, correct?
The church had ownership, but the church had not delegated to them the authority to transfer the property.
But here, this is not the corporation owning something. This is Mr. Banner owning something.
But he still did not have the authority under the operating agreement to transfer that without the members' consent. It's null and void for the same reason. Based on the organic document, and again, the statute governing LLCs in 10781084 says it is the intent of this article to give the maximum effect to the enforceability of operating agreements. And so this operating agreement has the power, the law has to give this the maximum effect. When you give the maximum effect, it says, unless the other members agree, give their written prior consent to an assignment, you, this other member, you don't have any authority or ability to assign any portion of your membership interest.
Okay.
So.
You're not using the words of the agreement here. You're using your own words saying you don't have this authority. And I guess that's exactly what I'm asking you, is you want us to read those words into this. You
right.
Want,
if the operating agreement says you can't assign even a portion of your membership interest without the other member's assent, then you just can't do it. And any assignment made without that consent that purports to be valid isn't. And there's nothing either the S nor the S and E can do to make it valid. And I think if you look at the case.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Mann, if I may, please. Are you familiar with Parish Chiropractic versus Progressive Casualty?
No, I'm not. I may have been at one time when I, is that a no-fault case back in the days of no-fault?
It's an old PIP case.
Yeah. But I did hear what you said, and exactly that principle is exactly what's applicable here. And in the briefs, both all of the defendants and the supplemental authority we filed last week, we cited cases from across the country, all holding, without exception, that purported transfers of interest in limited liability companies are void if they are made without the consent of the other members, if the operating agreement requires prior consent of the other members to effect a transfer. And although we haven't found any Colorado authority on point, the case you cited, the Parish versus Progressive, sounds like it's an application of the same principle. If you have an entity and you have an organic document that governs that entity, and again, let's look at the statute 78108. It says that the operating agreement governs the rights, duties, limitations, qualifications, and relations among the managers, the members' assignees and transferees, and the limited liability company. So this is the organic document that governs this. It says no transfers. There shall not be a transfer except with the prior written approval. Again, that's a fundamental principle of limited liability law. And all the cases we cited, in fact, all the cases we've been able to find on this have all said that any conveyance of any type of property, whether it's property, a membership interest, right to distributions, that is done without the consent of the other members, where the operating agreement requires it, is, and as his courts have used the word, null, void, and of no effect.
I want to ask a question about the plaintiff's severance argument here. I get why the partners would have some justifiable interest in saying, we don't like this voting agreement. That's going to mess up the operations of the LLC. But why do they care about distributions? Why does it matter?
Because under the statute, the person who has a right to distribution stands in the position as a creditor of the LLC. So if this were a valid assignment, then the plaintiff would have become a creditor of the LLC. And it's different from having people you associate with being your creditors and the hostile ex-wife of a member being a creditor.
It's only a a difference if they decide not to pay, isn't it?
Well, you know, creditors have certain rights in this state, and some of the actions creditors can take are not what the defendants would have wanted or would have desired in any situation. But as far as the severability, the assignment itself is invalid. The assignment itself is void. So there's nothing to sever. You're severing one void provision from another void provision. You end up with void provisions. So the entire assignment is void, and under those situations, I think that you can't sever off one part and have the whole thing remain valid when the entire agreement was void from the beginning.
So am I correct then that really your essential argument is quite simple? Paragraph 10.1 of the agreement is a determination of power. It is not a question of an obligation to the company. It's simply an agreement that you lack authority to assign your personal interest.
Right, and the idea is to control the membership of the LLC, so you don't suddenly find yourself in a small corporation with people you don't want to be in there with, people you don't like, people you don't trust. Let's assume the opposite. Let's assume that notwithstanding the provision in that operating agreement, the members can freely transfer not only their right to receive distribution, but their membership interests. The result of that is going to be commercial chaos, because you're going to have people selling out their interests, and you're going to have companies not being able to control their membership, which is the idea, one of the underlying ideas of a limited liability company.
So are you arguing then, one, the statute establishing LLCs and the purposes of LLCs establish a policy? Here, this agreement should be interpreted consistent with that policy.
Yes.
Is it possible that members of an LLC could write an agreement that would simply say, you know, we don't care about that. We understand what the statute says, but among us, it's freely alienable. You can take your interest and it's freely alienable.
Absolutely right. Section 8108 sets forth what provisions of an operating agreement must have. It also sets out some things that can't be waived, but it also says that the operating agreement can aside from these certain restrictions, the operating agreement can provide pretty much whatever the members want. And if they want freely alienable membership interests, I'm sure they could provide for that. They just didn't provide for that here, and that's why the judgment should be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Mann. Mr. Plott.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to follow up with that. The numerous cases that stand for the proposition, really the bankruptcy cases that stand for the proposition that the assignment of a membership interest in an LLC is void. You're talking about one, a totally different set of public policy considerations bankruptcy courts rely heavily on their state laws to determine exemptions and dischargeability. When bankruptcy proceedings are commenced, the bankruptcy court, of course, acquires control over the debtor's assets and has the power to discharge debts, but you're talking about a court of limited jurisdiction. What the defendants are reading into the operating agreement that is not present, but it is present in, for example, the very lengthy Texas case, whose name escapes me, that they did cite, was the express language that said any assignment made contrary to this is void. That is not present in this operating agreement. And what you're talking about is simply, without having that language in this operating agreement, we're still talking about a simple breach of contract.
Pardon me, Mr. Plott. That's why I asked you about Parrish, because it appears that there are two lines of cases in this country. One line of cases that says they're only void if it expressly says it's void. There's another line, and some commentators have identified Colorado as falling into that because of Parrish, that says it's good enough that they say don't do this. So that's why I asked you about Parrish.
Yes, Your Honor, but the language that you read from Parrish does not say void, at least as I understand it. may be unenforceable, but not void. May be unenforceable against, could Mrs. Kondo have enforced this assignment against the hut at Avon? She never tried. Perhaps not. But that's not the issue here. She's seeking tortious interference because, as Judge Loeb noted, she was supposed to receive the distributions from the hut at Avon. Through Mr. Banner, from the hut at Avon, it didn't matter. She was supposed to receive that. What Mr. Banner did and what the defendants did deprived her of her hard bargained asset in the dissolution action.
If it's, it's unenforceable then. I mean, then if Ms. Kondo sues to enforce it, then under Parrish it would be unenforceable for whatever reason, whether it's void or...
It might be, but that's not the question here, because tortious interference, even with an unenforceable contract, because she expected to rely, she relied.
So she's saying, I have a contract with Mr. Banner, and you've tortiously interfered with that contract when you bought him out.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The case of Kondo against Connors, Roberts, and Porterfield is now submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course. We have a 230 docket. There you go.